لولاك المؤمن توجد
another episode of Yoga Chat with the Accidental Yogist. It's Wednesday, August the 10th, 1 p.m. Pacific on killradio.org. And we're having really weird weather these days. Just when we thought it was hot in the heat wave, it's getting cold again and it seems like fall. But anyway, the whole episode this week is because there's a Moksha Festival here in Santa Monica this coming weekend. So I thought I would feature speakers and the music from Moksha Festival, only because it doesn't get the press that a lot of the bigger festivals have been getting. And so on the show today, in the studio actually, I have Felicia Tomasco. I'm going to turn up her microphone, who is the editor of LA Yoga Magazine and is involved in Moksha Festival. I believe she'll be one of the speakers there. So hi, Felicia.
Hi, Joni, and Yoga Chat with the Accidental Yogist.
Hi, it's good to have you here again after a long absence.
I know, it's nice to be here in the actual studio again. I think the last time I was participating in the show, it was from being on the phone, so it's nice to be here in the studio. And the Moksha Festival is happening this weekend in Santa Monica on August 13th and 14th, and LA Yoga is proud to be one of the sponsors of the event. And as you said, I will be also speaking at the event, and I'm going to be speaking Sunday morning on practices from Ayurveda and yoga to strengthen the immune system. It's one of my favorite topics because I think it's something we all need to know and remember.
I think so, especially with the changing weather, like I said, you know, you go from really, really hot to really, really cold, and next thing you know, your resistance is down, and next thing you know, you're getting sick with something. So I think trying to figure out how to strengthen your immune system is a very good thing, especially this time of year. I have to say that Felicia was so kind to bring me lunch today. She probably knows that I tend to run here from something on an empty stomach. And I think I mentioned it last week when I was talking with Dan O'Scott from Fearless Chocolate. Oh, no, it wasn't him. It was Chef Gage from the All One Kitchen. We were talking about his food, and I was drooling because I hadn't eaten anything all day. And so she brought me some food from Trader Joe's.
I'm sorry it's not a food truck, Joni, but...
But you know what? It's good stuff. It's a hummus wrap with vegetables, and, you know, I've always mentioned about, you know, sources for vegetarian food, so Trader Joe's is obviously a good source, because right here's the proof, hummus wrap with vegetables. So I'm going to have this in a while, probably when I'm playing.
And it's even vegan.
It's vegan.
It's a vegan... So I had time to go to Trader Joe's this morning. I do know that you have habits sometimes of not planning your food. And I also know you have a habit sometimes of coming to my house to eat. So I figured I would bring... I know I didn't cook this time, but I brought some food to you. It's also an important aspect of strengthening our own body's resilience and strengthening our immune system is making sure that we're well nourished and we have some good vegetables and nutrients and vitamins and... food on a regular basis.
And well hydrated too. Because I have here part of the whole Wanderlust Fest thing, more honest tea. I brought home so many honest tea samples, I swear. I think I'm living off honest tea. So anyway, let me see. So Moksha Festival, I think the thing about Moksha Festival is that it's unlike the other yoga festivals, which has been yoga and music, this one has more of an Ayurvedic slant, which is why, you know, Felicia, being the expert in Ayurveda, is one of the speakers who are going to be there. And I had printed out a list of the people there, and, you know, there will only be actually two yoga classes held during the event. One will be on Saturday with Andres Salcedo at 4:30 p.m., and then on Sunday there's one with Sarah Ivanhoe at 3 o'clock. Other than that, it's all workshops and discussions about Ayurveda and other things related to that. And then there's kirtan, obviously, in the evening. And so the music, I should introduce that first song. I forgot to do that. That was from Momo Ludiyi. I hope I pronounced his name correctly. And while he won't be headlining anything or playing specifically he doesn't show up on the schedule, he will be playing with Jai Utal on Saturday night. So I thought, oh, this is good. I had a copy of his album, and I've never played it yet on the show, so that was a good reason to play his music. Now, the other thing, too, I'm going to feature besides the speakers on the show is that, hold on a second, Jai Utal and Donna DeLore are going to be there, and they're the headliners, definitely. Jai's going to be there on Saturday, and Donna's going to be there on Sunday. But I've played their music a number of times on this show, so I thought this would be a good chance to highlight the people, the lesser-known people. In fact, most of the people don't even have albums, so I will be playing their music, and thank you to them for supplying me with MP3s at the very last minute so I could play them. So anyway, our first speaker will be calling soon. Let me see if I can...
Yeah, and Joni, I just want to make a point to add on to something you said a few moments ago, that
sure,
there's only one yoga class. There's not as much asana in this festival, but there are many of the other aspects of yoga and traditional sciences and traditional arts. There will be an art show. There is There are classes on Tantra. There are classes on Jyotish, which is Vedic astrology. There are classes on Vastu. There are classes on some of the therapeutic aspects of yoga. There are classes on meditation. So it's actually going to be a rich experience in terms of content and in terms of the types of classes that people don't always have the opportunity to enjoy on a regular basis.
You know, that's very true. If you were to look for that, you wouldn't even know where to start looking. So this is your chance, you know, all in one place. It's easy. Not only that, it's in Santa Monica. Now, I know the website says it's the Santa Monica College Performing Arts stage or something, but it is not on the campus on Pico and 20th. So it's happened to me many times because I've done the KCRW Pledge Drive, which, by the way, starts this week. But I've had people show up on that campus looking for the Broad stage, expecting the stage to be there, and it's not. It's in a separate location, off-campus location on Wilshire and 11th Street, I believe. That's where the Broad stage is, and it's very accessible by bus, by car, free parking, and by bicycle. There are bike racks there.
It's Santa Monica Boulevard.
Is it Santa Monica Boulevard?
It's Santa Monica Boulevard.
Oh, see, this is what happens when you live in Santa Monica and both parallel streets seem the same to you.
It's Santa Monica Boulevard and 11th.
And 11th.
So if you're driving down Wilshire, you'll also miss it.
You will miss it, too. That's true.
So Santa Monica Boulevard, and there is free parking.
That's true.
And there are bike racks.
If you go to Wilshire and 11th, you'll end up at, what's the name of the Mexican place again?
I don't know, but you'll end up at the Golden Mean, which is a really good vegan cafe.
That's Felicia's favorite place to be. That's true. So let me just double check and make sure our phone's working today before I keep going. Yeah, it looks like it. Okay, only because we have a phone call that's supposed to come in soon. I'm looking at my schedule and I do not have, I'm missing something here, which is really bizarre. But anyway, so let's see, let's talk about, okay, since we have you here, Felicia, I guess the whole point on my list was you're going to talk about Ayurveda in general and how it, you know, let's get a little teaser of what you're going to talk about at Moksha.
Well, just to give an idea, so the word Ayurveda is a Sanskrit word that means science of life. It's considered to be one of the sister sciences of yoga because it shares a lot of the same way of looking at the body and a lot of the same philosophy and a lot of the same perspective as does yoga. And what Ayurveda offers us is a system of healing that provides information on how we live our lives in harmony with and in balance with the world around us. So even though things in the world are constantly shifting and changing, which is something that can cause us some anxiety, or we can kind of learn to roll with it. And there's a famous quote by Swami Satchidananda that says, "Life is change, learn to surf." And Ayurveda provides some of the surfing instruction to keep our body healthy. So this weekend, I'll be speaking specifically about the immune system, and the immune system is seen in Ayurveda as our body's intelligence, because it's that system in the body that determines on a constant basis what's you and what's not you. You know, how do we, right? You think about it. What's you and what's not you? That's what the immune system does. It defends you against everything that's not you, and it makes sure that everything that is you is supposed to be there.
Are we just talking about physical body you, or, you know, I mean, how do you divide what's you and what's not you? I guess that's interesting.
It is interesting, and it's interesting, too, because if you think about it, we're always in constant interaction with the world around us, even in terms of exchange of electrons or exchange of breath or exchange of prana or exchange of information. And so then everything that happens around us, we take it in and digest it, and it actually becomes us. So what are the things that become us, whether we're talking about the physical body, which the word for the kosha, you know, we have in yoga and Ayurveda these levels or layers of the body, which are called the koshas. And the kosha of the physical body in Sanskrit is called the anamaya kosha, which literally means the body of food. So your physical body is made up of food. So the food that you eat, the hummus and the vegetables that you're about to eat right now.
The food that I'm actually eating while Felicia's talking.
Is going to physically become your body. You know, the structure of your body and the energy of your body. So the immune system is important in that. You know, what are actually the cells that belong to our physical body? And how do we protect those? So the immune system is a system of protection. It's a system of intelligence. It's a system of strength and resilience. And we can do things to help protect and strengthen that, like eating lunch. Ayurveda holds great importance on the ritual of lunchtime.
And it's also the kind of food you eat, I would think, right?
It is the kind of food that you eat. You want to eat food that you actually want to become part of you.
Does that include chocolate?
Well, if you want chocolate to become part of you.
Yes, I definitely want chocolate to be part of
you. Now, it's also like, do you want, like, you know, fake sort of artificial sugars to become part of you, or pesticides to become part of you, or, you know, things that involve cruelty to become part of you? Those are all good questions. So that's why, you know, from the perspective of yoga and Ayurveda, the kinds of food that we put in our body really do influence, not just from a nutritional basis, but also from that subtle energetic basis. When we eat food that is grown with love or cooked with love or that is organic, it not only feeds us and nourishes us, but then it also feeds us and nourishes us on those subtler levels.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, if you think of it that way, and you think about, you know, where your food came from and how the food was produced, in a way, I mean, I can understand why a lot of people now have stopped eating meat, only because, you know, especially if they've read about exactly how animals are slaughtered or how they are raised, and you think about all that negative energy that was involved in that, and then, you know, bringing it into your body. I mean, I can totally see why some people don't eat meat at all. Wow. Makes you want to grow your own food.
It's food for thought.
I know it is.
But it does make you think about, like, I love shopping at farmers markets, and I love shopping. I love vegetables. I love getting things from people who have grown things in their yard. I am not yet growing things myself in the current place where I live. But even if you have just a kitchen garden or a pot with some herbs or something very simple, you're adding that energy to your food.
Yeah. Wow. I'm speechless, only because it's funny. I have to say that I try to eat healthy, but last night I was out and about watching a screening of a movie, got home late, and I was hungry. On my way home, I got really, really hungry. And I didn't have a lot of cash in my wallet, so I ended up driving by a Taco Bell, and I picked up a bean burrito. And granted, it didn't have any meat in it. I'm just thinking, like, there was probably lard in it. It was probably something not good in it, but I ate it, and it cost less than a buck. And I think that's the thing, too. You know, the sad thing is that a lot of food that is very, very affordable, unfortunately, isn't always good for you. And if you go to the better places, then you end up spending much more money for food, which is better for you. So I guess you start thinking about that. I think you have to be more conscious about it, which is why I suppose if you grow your own food, then it definitely becomes cheaper.
Or even if you cook for yourself, and if you start to fix some items for yourself, even if you're buying your own food, you can still fix things like simple burritos, like khichdi, which is mung beans and rice, or vegetable dishes for very inexpensive, you know, that are very inexpensive, and you can even share them with your friends.
Yeah.
As Joni knows.
Yeah, when Felicia is home long enough to cook, then she'll cook a big pot and invite everybody over. Next thing you know, all the neighbors are over eating from the communal pot.
Including Joni. Well, you get your own bowls.
We do. But there's this big pot of good, healthy food, and all of us are there. He's like, oh, yeah, Felicia cooked. Here we are. And, of course, I'll eat the pepper that's in the pot. But anyway, okay, so the other thing about Ayurveda is you normally think about the different constitutions of people, you know, the vata, the pitta, the kapha. Can you go into that a little briefly for people who don't really know what that's all about and how that maybe might affect you know, your immune system and all that stuff and eating?
Well, here's the thing about Ayurveda, because it's an energetic system. We look at the world in terms of different kinds of energetic qualities, and those energetic qualities are based on the five elements: ether, empty space, air, fire, water, and earth. And those five elements are grouped into three categories called the three doshas, and those are vata, which are the elements of ether and air, pitta, which is fire and a little bit of water, and kapha, which is water and earth. And those are present within our own bodies, within our minds, and within the world around us. And they're constantly, there's a little bit of fluctuation. Like right now we're in the midst of summer, which is a season that's characterized by a predominance of the Pitta dosha. We'll be moving into fall in a few months, which is a season characterized by predominance of the Vata dosha. It's dry, airy, gets colder, becomes dark. As we go into the winter and into the rainy season, we start to move into the season characterized by the Kapha dosha, which is wet, which is cold, which is damp, and then moves into the spring, which is a season of growth, because Kapha is associated with growth, as it is associated with the earth and with water. And so we have these qualities in our own body. We all contain some aspect of all three elements, but we have them in different proportions. So some people may have a higher proportion of, say, the earth and water elements, which would be Kapha. Some people have a higher proportion of fire. Some people have a higher proportion of air and space. And we can even talk about that. We call somebody an airhead. We call somebody fiery. We call somebody an earth mother. And so we recognize those qualities in people, even though we contain all of them in different parts of our body. They do predominate a little bit, and we see the influence of that. So it's not about trying to become something we're not. It's about embracing who we are and finding balance with compassion.
So it's definitely not only just a personality thing, but it's also physical, right? You can see people, what they are, from like having dry skin, oily skin, because I know people have just looked at me without knowing me and says, oh, you are definitely, you know, whatever it is. So it's just an all-around thing, correct?
It's a combination of physical attributes and mental attributes and different things. And we can also see the different doshas play out in different parts of our body. So we may see, you know, even if we're a person who has a predominantly pitta constitution, we may see elements of kapha in different parts of the body, whether it's in the mind, whether it's in the physical body. But it is a system that looks at, you know, everything and all of the different aspects of who we are. So it is something that appears physically, it is something that appears personality-wise, it is something that appears in, say, how we sleep. And these doshas can be in a state of balance, which means that who we are doesn't mean that they're all the same, but it means for us that we have a sense of feeling at home in our own body and things are in a state of balance versus being in a state of being out of balance, which means that one or two or three of the doshas are kind of more or less than what is our basic constitution and they're wreaking havoc.
So what happens if you are imbalanced? For example, if somebody says to me, you are very pitta, and I know there are things that aggravate the pitta dosha, things that I shouldn't be eating a lot of because it just brings out more pitta. So what happens if I am overly pitta? What would happen to me?
Well, if we take pitta, for example, which is the fire element, so if your general constitution has a lot of pitta, then you may be more prone to pitta going out of balance or increasing or causing problems, because it's kind of like you have a cup that's almost full. And if you put more water in the cup, it has a tendency to overflow if you're not careful, if you just like leave the faucet on. And so the things that increase the energy of pitta are things with the same quality, things that are hot, things that are spicy, things that are oily. And this can be food, this can be weather, this can be other people, this can be circumstances. It's all sorts of things. It can be what we wear. So let's say you're a person who has a lot of the pitta dosha and you're feeling particularly fiery and you wear a bunch of red clothes. And it's August, and you sit out in the sun for a long time.
Eating spicy food,
and then you're stuck in a traffic jam, and you get really frustrated, and people are cutting you off. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah, so
right?
Then what happens? Do I just sort of like...
Well, you may feel angry,
implode.
You may feel irritated, you may implode, your skin may start to break out, you know, redness, hives, inflammation, irritation, those kinds of things are characteristics physically of pitta going out of balance. Anger, frustration are emotions of pitta going out of balance. And that's not to say that anger is sometimes an appropriate emotion, but it's just what are the circumstances that we're responding to. So those things play in. And so the way to bring the pitta dosha into balance are things with the opposite qualities. So things that are cooling. This is why people who have a lot of the pitta dosha tend to have a sweet tooth, because the sweet taste tends to actually calm pitta.
Ooh.
Now in Ayurveda, the sweet taste is not just sugar or chocolate. It also includes things like whole grains, dairy products, if you eat dairy products, oils, things like avocado, things like rice. So it probably boba, you know, is also has some of the sweet taste.
So like rice milk, you know, ice
rice
cream.
Rice milk, ice cream, coconut water.
That's all good stuff then.
It's all stuff that calms the Pitta dosha. Now, from an Ayurvedic perspective, we don't really look at things in terms of good and bad. It really relates to what's the relationship of something that we're talking about.
Like, for example, something sweet might be bad for another dosha. Like, which dosha would that not be good for?
So let's say, you know, you have something like coconut bliss or coconut ice cream. It's great in and of itself, like especially if you have it at, say, 3 in the afternoon on a really hot, sunny day, you're having something that's cooling. But let's say you have coconut bliss at 2 in the morning during the kapha season, which is the winter, and somebody's already feeling kind of sluggish and they have a cold, then you're just increasing those same cold qualities.
Now, what dosha did you say that was? The cold winter?
Cold winter is kapha.
God, I think I'm that too. I think I'm a...
Well, remember, we all contain some aspect of all three doshas.
Exactly.
So whenever we read about them or whenever we see something about Ayurveda, we'll see something and we'll relate to all of them. Oh, that's me. Oh, that's me. Oh, that's me. Because we all have all three doshas. Because if we didn't have all three doshas, we wouldn't have a physical body. That would be thing number one, because the physical body is related to the earth element or the element of kapha. You know, we wouldn't be able to, you know, have movement in our body, because movement is related to the air and ether elements, the dosha of vata. And then the quality of transformation, digestion, passion, are all related to the fire element, which is the pitta dosha.
Now all of a sudden I'm craving coconut bliss. Okay, I know where I'm going after this.
On your way to the SRF convocation tonight to meditate.
It's fun. That's tonight at the Bonaventure Hotel. Actually, it's going on all week, and I think it's open to the public, right? Can they buy tickets on site, or do you have to buy them in advance?
I don't know the answer to that, but the Self-Realization Fellowship Convocation does have a website, and you can look up and see what the event information is. But if you are somebody who is a follower through the Self-Realization Fellowship of Yogananda, it's the largest gathering of that group every year. Some 5,000 plus people are gathered for different talks and events at the Western Bonaventure Hotel downtown.
Right, I know Felicia's gone to this many, many years. This is going to be my very first time going, and it's more for me to experience it and see what it's all about.
And you'll get to meditate with thousands of other people.
Oh, this will be fun. This will be fun, meditating in a ballroom.
Yes.
With thousands of people.
You may reach enlightenment.
I might. Is it anything close to like the Amma experience, where you're sitting in Amma's presence and sitting?
Well, it has a completely different feel to it than the Amma experience, but similarities in that the goal of both is to find that way to get in touch with the self. Mm-hmm. You know, Amma's is a little bit more of kind of a festival atmosphere, where this is a little bit more of, I don't want to use the word serious, but just a little quieter. But there is still a great depth of devotion. There's still a great depth of devotion. And it's just, is that devotion... Does everybody sit in rows, or does everybody kind of wander around and...
Yeah, what do they do? I mean, I'm trying to... See, I want to make sure I don't look totally out of place in something like this. So is it like going to church with somebody like the Pope up front, and you have to pay the deepest respect and be really, you know, respectful of everything that's going on and just speak in hushed voices and all that stuff?
Well, there is definitely a sense of respect, because there is a sense of this is the community of people, or one community of people, who see Yogananda as their guru. And so there's definitely that acknowledgement of that. There is definitely an acknowledgement of the deep teachings. When I was at the convocation the other night, the talk was on the yamas and niyamas from Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. So there is a diving into the teachings. There is some chanting and there is some meditation. So we see different ways that people express and experience and share these practices.
Yeah, tonight I think the topic is stress, which is very appropriate for, you know, these times, these days, and all the crazy things that are going on, including these... Supposed stock market crash. Not that it's crashing, but it's crashing slowly. But anyway, I guess.
Well, I think if we look at the current instability of the stock market. It's also remembering that each one of us has really the power to find stability in our own lives amidst a very changing world. We can look at these times, we can look at any time in history, because we could probably ask anybody at any time in history if they feel a sense of insecurity, and they would always say yes. So that is why there's a great benefit to these teachings being available, because they give us a means by which we can find security and stability even in during change.
Oh, definitely. Looking at the clock, it's time to play the next song. So here's somebody, Cooper Madison. For those of you who are not familiar, well, for those of you from LA who are in the bhakti scene, you are very familiar with Cooper. Very, very talented. He plays the harmonium. He plays the tabla. He plays almost any instrument you can think of. He also chants. He has a beautiful voice, and he will be chanting. There will be kirtan with Cooper on Saturday, I believe it is, in the evening. So, you know, they do have tickets. If you don't want to do the workshops, you can buy a ticket just for the evening kirtan, which starts at 6 o'clock in the evening. And so here's something he actually sent me. It's an MP3, and he doesn't have an album. He's one of those people who needs to come up with an album soon, so people will know what he's all about. But this is the Hare Krishna. So I am going to play this, and I'll catch you at the other end.
Hare Rama.
Hi, I'm back. Oops. And I have on the phone Bill Levasi. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Levasi.
Who will be one of the speakers at Moksha. And let me bring up the phone. Bill, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
So I'm going to let you introduce yourself. I mean, we've never met before. The only reason why I know about you is because I saw your name on the list of speakers, and the thing that got me was Vedic astrology, which I know nothing about. And luckily, Felicia Tomasco, who's here with me today, knows you, so she was able to, you know, make this happen, and so I have you on the phone. So please introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Levasi, and I'm speaking today about Vedic astrology. It's called Jyotish in India, which means, Jyoti means light, and Ish or Ishwara means mastery. So it's mastery of light, but also insight, and basically giving a person an understanding of their behavior and how that behavior unfolds over time. So as an astrologer, you know, I've been doing Vedic astrology since 1983 and written three books, and I'm currently the president of the American College of Vedic Astrology, where we offer Vedic astrology courses online. And so I've been keeping busy with things like that. I'm also a PhD candidate in education at Capella University, so I'm busy right now quite a bit finishing up my dissertation, so keeping myself, keeping my behavior very full of time. So that's basically just an overview of, you know, what I do and where I'm at.
Now, you know, in terms of astrology, you keep, I think, astrology is reading stars, reading planets, where everything is and how it affects people. Is Vedic astrology anything like that?
Yeah, Vedic astrology, again, it's the study of, you know, how our behavior might unfold over time. We call that karma, past, present, and future behavior. And it's based on this concept of correspondence of the laws of nature on a macro level, you know, big, big universal cosmic level. In Vedic philosophy, they call that Kala Purusha, the body of the cosmos. And that particular body is also related to the personal body or the person. They call that Jiva Purusha. But it's based on the correspondence between cycles of nature and rhythms of nature and how those are unfolded and identified in terms of one's personal behavior. So the idea is, how can I perform best in time according to the best qualities of my nature? And using the clocks and calendars of astronomical systems to help us identify when those timing cycles and rhythms are in place.
So do you have a sign, like, you know, the usual pickup, you know, your pickup line is, hi, I'm a Capricorn, what's your sign? Do you have signs in Vedic astrology?
Yeah, what's interesting, there are 12 what we call the sun signs, which they have in Western astrology, sometimes called tropical astrology. I'm not an expert in tropical astrology, but I can just speak to it a little bit. But they have the 12 signs of the zodiac, and also in the Vedic system, which is also true in some other Eastern systems, they have a lunar zodiac. They have 27 moon signs, which are called nakshatras. And these give additional layers of interpretation and meaning. So you can have your sun sign, and then you can have your moon sign. What's also important, and we can discuss it maybe more in a little bit, but one of the big differentiators between Vedic astrology and tropical astrology is that the Vedic system tries to keep the symbolic signs of the zodiac in alignment with the star groups that they represent. What happens over time, probably since around 200 AD, the stars, the way the Earth relates to the stars, the Earth wobbles backwards on its axis. They call it precession. And so about every 72 years, the sun rises up about 1 degree later. So the difference between the Western and the Vedic system, the Western system doesn't track this wobbling. So they are using a zodiac that star base would have been in place about 2,000 years ago. And the Vedic system tries to keep adjusting for this wobbling so that the signs of the zodiac stay in alignment with the star groups they represent. So what that does in the people that are familiar with the tropical charts, unless you're born between the 15th and 20th of the month, you know, roughly in that little time frame, mm-hmm. your sun sign, many of your planets will move back one sign. So a person thought they were Leo, they become a, you know, become a Cancer. And like I remember when I was, I never really studied, again, Western astrology in any great depth, but everyone kind of knows what their Western sun sign was. And I remember all through my life, I was supposedly sun in Aries. And then when I did the Vedic system, my sun actually moved back into Pisces. And, you know, looking at everything in a larger perspective, to me, that made a whole lot more sense. So
how do you determine what your sign is? Do you actually have to go to an astrologer who then determines where everything was the day you were born, the time you were born?
Well, yeah. You provide the time, date, and place of your birth. And depending on your expertise and how deep you want to go into it, you know, there are software programs that a person can buy, and there are software services on the Internet that could tell you just what your basic parameters are, like here's your sun, and here's your moon, here's your rising sign. Those are like the three big hitters in terms of understanding what your chart might reveal. So you can go to an astrologer to figure that out, and then he would interpret that, he or she, in detail, so you understand the overall pattern of your behavior and how that might unfold over time. Or if you're just a beginner and you want to kind of see what's going on, you can you get a software program and look up stuff in a book. I mean, that's how I started. That's how a lot of people start. In fact, my last two books have a CD in them, and it has a free software program where you can actually calculate your chart and then look up stuff in the book. So it depends on, you know, how deeply you want to go into it and how much time you want to spend on it yourself. Some people are very curious and want to do it themselves, and other people just want to consult with a professional and have them do all the legwork and just find out what the results may be.
So the same thing too. Your sign determines your basic personality or disposition or
right,
something like that.
Right. It's a tendency to act in a certain way, and the idea is that you're born into this lifetime with a certain propensity or tendency to act a certain way based on what might be seen in the chart. Chart's really a map. It tells you where New York might be and if you would be benefited by going there, more or less. So those kind of things can happen when you're analyzing the chart and just get an understanding of your basic disposition. And then the idea, which I think is really great in Vedic astrology, is not just understanding what your current behavior is, which is represented by your chart, but what your tendency to improve and how you may determine ways and means to improve the way you act so your results in life get better. You know, hopefully as we live our life and as it unfolds, our life gets healthier and happier, our attitudes towards, you know, dealing with the various ups and downs of life, you know, becomes more unagitated, more balanced, tranquil, peaceful, more effective, those kind of things. So, again, Vedic astrology is a tool to help us understand how to get maximum results, you know, from the potential that we see in the chart.
So, for example, if you want to start a new business, you can go to an astrologer who will say it's more likely to be successful if you do it between this time and this time rather
right.
than that time and that time.
Right, or it might be better that you work for somebody else and not for yourself. Or it might be better that you work for a medical engineering company rather than a defense engineering company. You know, it can give you a lot of detail about what particular kind of actions might be more favorable for you and actually more in line with your aptitudes and your skills and your interests. And getting that alignment, then we're happier in what we do and more motivated, and we tend to stay with something a bit longer.
Wow. Maybe I should get my charts read.
Yeah, it's like understanding, you know, with greater clarity. I think people have a kind of a an idea. But, you know, doubt's always a problem, and lack of clarity about, you know, well, I think I want to be an engineer, but, you know, I want to be a doctor too. Well, then maybe I should be a doctor using, you know, medical breakthroughs and help people in that regard. You know, so you can see these tendencies and blend them in ways that help people, again, you know, maximize their potential.
Okay, the other thing that you were going to talk about, I believe that you were going to talk about Vedic astrology on Saturday, correct?
Correct.
So on Sunday, you're going to talk about what they call Vedic feng shui. What exactly is that?
It's called Vastu.
Okay.
And Vastu can translate as dwelling. So it's about having the proper environment. You know, your astrology chart can tell you about dispositions of behavior, but the context in which you behave, you know, your environment, has a big impact on what you do. So Vastu tells us what are the most appropriate patterns of living in terms of the structure of your house, the orientation to the, you know, the magnetic fields and the solar, you know, energy, just, you know, more in terms of your structure and aligning more with nature in terms of your physical placement on the earth, in your office space, in your home space, you know, those kind of things. So it has some similarities to the intention of feng shui. Again, I'm not an expert in feng shui, but there's even some research that says, you know, since many Buddhist and Chinese philosophies and systems came from India, that maybe some of the roots of feng shui, you know, have their basis in Vastu. Vastu is just becoming known by the West, so a lot of people are familiar somewhat with the concepts of feng shui, but Vastu is another part of that integrated system. So as your previous speaker, Felicia, was saying, you know, Ayurveda helps you live healthy, you know, mind, body, and spirit, and then Ayurveda is then complemented by Jyotish, which tells you, you know, this is how you would best behave in terms of time. And then Vastu tells you in terms of place. So you've got mind, body, spirit functioning properly within time in the right location. And then doing that, your potential, your opportunity to maximize your potential goes way up because everything's more harmonic, more in alignment. That's the whole idea behind these Vedic systems, is to put us properly in alignment with all the various forces of nature so that we, again, live healthily and happily.
I kind of like that. Since I know nothing about that, I know I definitely want to go to the festival and listen to all of this because it's all new to me, and I'm sure there are a lot of people out there, too, who know nothing about this, so this would be good, and I'm definitely going to go to your to your talk Saturday and Sunday. Let me see. Felicia, do you have anything you want to say?
It makes me want to make sure that my house is properly aligned in terms of Vastu, so I think I should go to the talk.
No, you should go to the talk, or you should invite Bill over for food. You should cook something, invite Bill over, and maybe he can, you know, tell you about the Vastu ability of your home. Is there such a word, Bill?
it's the arrangement of your home. Like, for example, anything dealing that's more pitta, fiery and things like that, that goes into what they call the Agni corner, Agni's fire, and that's the southeast. So in a particular house, having your kitchen where fire obviously takes place in the southeast is good. And if you have a particular room, let's say a computer room, you would want your mechanical devices that consume a lot of electricity and power like that to be in the southeast corner of that room. So you take the various functions of the components of your living space and put them in the right area, you know, of the house, and then the house, it's just like a guitar. You're tuning up the guitar of your house, more or less, so it can play all these rhythms of nature in a very beautiful kind of way.
Well, I guess for me, it's good to know that my computer is in my bedroom, which is in the southeast corner of my home, so I guess it's good for me. How about you, Felicia? I'm trying to remember.
Well, I'm just thinking my kitchen is not necessarily in the southeast part of the home, but the stove is in the southeast corner of the kitchen.
Does that count?
I couldn't hear Felicia very well.
Oh, I guess he can't hear you. Felicia is saying that her kitchen is not in the southeast corner of her home.
Right.
But her stove is in the southeast corner of that kitchen.
See, that's the second best thing you can do. Optimally, you know, if a person was fortunate enough to be able to build their home from scratch or have enough foster knowledge to buy a home that met those requirements, you would want the kitchen in the southeast. Not everybody has that, and they can't sell their house or do that kind of thing necessarily. So in the room that is your kitchen, having the fire element in the southeast corner of your kitchen room, that's a very helpful thing to do.
Well, there you go. So I guess you got something right in your house.
Yeah, you can treat each room as a module of your entire house and then take the rules of Jyotish specifically into that unit of your home and arrange it correctly in that way.
Okay, so one question I want to know is there such a thing as a money corner of your home?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, where would that
be? The whole north side is called Kubera, the Lord of Wealth. For example, if a person runs a business, they're recommended to keep their money storage or their valuables or their precious articles in the north part of the building, maybe a safe or something like that. And in a person's own home, that would be good to have, you know, important kinds of things, the big valuables and things, maybe one's jewelry or whatever it is, you know, in that north section, which is the Kubera side of the house.
Well, that's Felicia's kitchen is in the north side, so her wealth is food.
Yeah, maybe she has her refrigerator there. All those expensive dishes could be kept in there.
Well, you know, it's true, her desk. The office desk is in the north corner. At least she, see, everything in her place seems to be going right. And I'm thinking that what's in the north side of my place is my kitchen, which I don't spend much time in because I spend more time, I think, eating in Felicia's kitchen, or my kids' room. It's like, wait, so maybe that's why my kids have all my money.
They say in terms of planning and the person who is the master of the house, and I won't get into the debate of who should be the master in the house, but the northeast is considered a fortunate area. It's ruled by Jupiter, and it's a very spiritual part. Functionally, one's mastery of one's wealth and planning and just your overall organization of life is in the southwest corner. In fact, they recommend that the master of the house, the man and the woman or whoever's owning or living in the house, have their bed in the southwest side of the house. And again, if not, at least put your bed in the southwest corner of your room. And interestingly enough, very strong recommendation to have your head while you sleep pointing towards the south, so your feet are to the north. And so that's a big recommendation in terms of orientation of the head while you sleep and the orientation of the bed in the bedroom of the house. And so there's all this stuff about rhythm and healthy kind of environment that energetically reflects, interestingly enough, the magnetic field of the earth intermixing or intersecting with the solar radiation from the sun. It forms a grid. So the idea is to get as rightly placed on that grid in the building you're living in or the building you're working in to get maximum energy efficiency and success. You know, playing again, the house metaphorically being the instrument of your living, it's like a guitar. You want to play everything right, you know, through the instrument of your house.
Okay, now that I'm totally depressed because my bed is in the wrong place, which is my bedroom, which is in the wrong place of the house, and I'm facing the wrong direction, it's like, oh, my God, I think I need to move. But anyway.
Well, you know, you can do a few of these simple corrections without, you know, blowing up your house, and people often report noticing a little more energy and enthusiasm when they get as much as they can out of their house, you know, without tearing out walls and things like that. Just orienting the various rooms as best they can. And at least, you know, quantitatively, they're improving their environment.
Well, I'll have to look at that. But we're kind of running out of time here. So thanks a lot, Bill, for enlightening me and everybody else. And I definitely look forward to seeing you this weekend.
All right. Well, thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was really interesting.
Wow, my head is facing east, and my bedroom is in the southeast corner, and I'm trying to think. Everything is wrong.
You could just move your bed.
I know, but then
to
I would
a different
be
part of the room.
Basically putting my bed out in the balcony. I think if I did that.
You could have your bed next to the balcony in the southwest corner.
Hmm.
But it did make me think I need to move my bed to the southwest corner. So it's time for me to rearrange my bedroom.
No, my closet's in the southwest corner by the door to the balcony. So I would just be in the way of my closet door and my balcony door. Anyway, it's time to play more music. Oh, I know what we're going. This is going to be an interesting thing because the person I want to highlight music-wise is Daniel Stewart, who will be playing on Sunday. And he sent me an MP3, but it was of a live kirtan going on at Yogico. If you've ever been to Yogico, you know that it's a big room with high ceilings. And so while the kirtan going on was amazing, the sound quality was kind of echoey. So I found instead a YouTube video of a kirtan he had at Bhakti Yogashala. I think it was sometime last year. So I'm going to play that. So hopefully that will go fine. But hold on a second. Let me just fire that up. Okay, so good luck to all of us. Hopefully this will work. Oops. Sorry, just a second. Okay, here goes.
Shiva, 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 Shi
I'm hoping that came out okay. All I can say is it sounded better on my computer at home, but I'll find out when I get to listen to the podcast. So that was Daniel Stewart. He does kirtan monthly at Rising Lotus Yoga in the Valley, and he has been making appearances at other places on the West Side, like Bhakti Yogashala, where that came from, a yoga collective. It's another place in Santa Monica. And he's also been to Yoga Blend in Burbank. And he's also been to Inner Power, I believe, in Calabasas.
We went to see him at Inner Power.
Oh, we did. Okay.
Yeah.
So I wasn't imagining things. So he's not just kirtan in the 818. He's making his way around town. And this weekend, he will actually be at the Moksha Festival. On Sunday. So hopefully I did him justice with that. His kirtan tends to be, you know, each one is because it builds up slowly, gradually, and reaches a crescendo and then comes right back down. That was actually one of three YouTube videos for that particular song. So that was part three. So I decided to highlight, you know, the crescendo, as you would say, of his kirtan. So that gives you a good idea of how much energy just comes from his chanting. So while that was going on, Laura Amazoni, also who's another speaker at Moksha Festival, called in. And the reason why I thought she'd be interesting is because she's going to be talking about Tantra. And I don't know if you're like, you know, the usual person. The only time you hear Tantra is when you hear them talking about Sting and his marathon lovemaking sessions, which he attributes to his practice of yoga and Tantra. So we'll find out if there really is anything to do with that. So let me bring up the phone. Laura, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Joni.
Hi, Laura. So, again, we have met. We have met, but you've had workshops. But let me let you introduce yourself to everybody.
Great. My name is Laura Amazoni, and I am a teacher, a priestess, a yogini, and author of the book Goddess Durga and Sacred Female Power. And I offer workshops on goddesses, tantric philosophy, and teachings, really, of from the Shakta tradition, which is a female-centered tradition of South Asia, and looking at the different myths and philosophies as means of empowerment and liberation for women and men.
So how would men gain, you know, power through study of the goddesses? How did the goddesses affect men?
Because ultimately we are all female and male. We have these qualities that they call in this tradition Shakti Shiva. So Shakti is the female creative dynamic aspect that from the Shakta perspective pervades all existence. And the Shiva quality is the foundation. It's the ground of being. It's really that immutable quiescent quality. And ultimately it's the dance between them that through these various tantric practices that we're able to access. And so, and just this awareness of different goddesses and the way they play out in our lives and ourselves and different experiences we have is totally accessible to women and men. It is by no means exclusive to one sex over the other.
Give one example of a goddess and how it would affect us, or how, you know, what our relationship with that to that goddess would be.
Well, my personal favorite is goddess Durga, and I'm actually an initiated priestess of Durga. She is the goddess of strength. She's the goddess of justice. She's a remover of difficulty and fear, and her myth is really interesting because it's very applicable to these times. And just briefly, it's a story of these demonic forces that are destroying the equilibrium of the worlds, and the male gods are trying to stop these forces, and the methods they're using, primarily other violent methods, are not working. And so they know that it is only the wisdom of the Supreme Mother Goddess that can come and really make a difference. And so she comes, and the myth describes these three different battles and her whole approach. And it's so much about, you know, responding to different life situations from a place within that's centered and that's composed. And she really offers us that opportunity to confront adversity in our life, or these things that really challenge us, these things that seem difficult, from a place where we're more grounded. And so, yeah, she's a wonderful place to start, and I think that, you know, very timely for what's happening in the world today.
So what do people do then if they want to follow a goddess? Do they read about her? Do they pray to her? Do they, I mean, what exactly do you do then?
Well, I think there's a lot of teachings that are available. Definitely reading about these different faces of the divine female and seeing how they relate to your own life, exploring the myths and seeing if there's certain themes that you may want to meditate on through a meditation practice, a yoga asana practice, through a mantra practice. The mantra itself, from the tantric perspective, there's these mantras that are called bija mantras or seeds, and they really are the essence of the deity. So, for example, one of Durga's bija mantras is Hrim, and it's really a mantra of the heart center, and it really helps you to come in touch with that, you know, vibration of love from the center, but also a vibration of fierce compassion, and really how to navigate through these formidable experiences, and also how to surrender to both the more blissful aspects of experience as well as those that may be more frightening.
Okay, so that covers the goddess part of things. Now, Tantra itself, what does Tantra mean? Does it translate to anything?
Well, Tantra is actually a weaving of many different disciplines. It's a weaving of science, of ritual, of philosophy, yogic methodologies, and there are over 64 schools of Tantra within both the Hindu and Buddhist traditions. And ultimately, we could say that it's a means to understanding the mysteries of life in the universe. The root of the word tan means to spread or to propagate. It also has these connotations associated with weaving, and so ultimately weaving these different strands of life experience together to understand the greater fabric of the whole. And we could say that Tantra ultimately is this path of self-inquiry. It's about understanding the relationship between the inner and outer worlds. And there's a tantric saying that says that which is not in the body is not in the universe. So really, you know, exploring not only the physical body, but the subtle body and just different aspects of our consciousness to understand what is happening around us, and really connecting, seeing the bridge, these connections between inner and outer.
So a tantric practice, is that more of a physical practice, a spiritual practice? you know, a lifestyle practice? What exactly is it?
That's an excellent question, and it's all of the above.
It's all of the above.
It's really a philosophy, and it's not exclusive. It's the yoga asana practice. It's the meditation practice. It's a path, really, that includes Ayurveda, like Felicia was talking about earlier, about cultivating health, physical health, mental health, spiritual health, and, you know, really finding a way to live in balance. And really, again, you know, that whole idea of Durga, coming back to the center, coming back to this place of composure. You know, another thing about Durga, who is also a very tantric goddess, is that she has been described as the center of the storm. She is that place of calm. And again, all of these tantric practices, it's a way of life of responding to situations rather than reacting. And really asking ourselves, you know, what are our compulsions? What is at the root of any of these desires that we have? And how can we free ourselves from these things that actually can be harmful or more limiting or don't allow us to fully express our full nature? This is really a path about liberation, which this festival, moksha, that the word actually refers to liberation, about liberation within the body. And just looking at the ways that we're conditioned from our experiences, from our pasts, you know, from, you know, different social expectations, traditional gender roles and so forth, and really finding a way to break through them so we can, again, come back to our center and express who we are, who our essence is, and what it is that we've come here to do.
So if one wants to practice or learn more about a tantric practice, where does one go? Where does one, you know, find it? Do they have tantra classes?
Well, that's one thing. Yeah, there's a lot of different people that are out there teaching and calling the practice tantra, and it's not necessarily classical tantra. Any sort of classical tantric teacher will have a lineage. They will be connected to some sort of lineage. So this long line of teachers and masters that have been passed down over the ages. And, you know, there's a great emphasis today on tantra, meaning, you know, the sexual practices. And actually, that's not really tantra. That comes much, much later, after you have done, you know, years of practice in strengthening your physical body and the subtle bodies, and you come to a place to be working on that level. But there's a lot of different books that you can look at and different classes. I'm offering classes at Loyola this fall. I'm also teaching at Exhale in Venice, and just kind of giving, and at the Moksha Festival, we'll kind of be giving an overview of, you know, two different lineages within the tantric tradition and what they have to offer, and kind of as a springboard for people to go off then and see what else is, you know, comes along. It also really is a path, I find, when you open in this way, that, you know, they say that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And through this processing of opening and really sincerity and really coming from a place of humility and integrity, that a lot of synchronicities happen, and you'll just find yourself kind of led. I know that sounds kind of out there, but it's really been true in my own experience on this path of really other ways of knowing and experiencing that have led me to my own teachers.
So, in other words, if I'm saying that I'm doing a tantric yoga practice, people shouldn't think, oh my God, that's an R-rated thing, and how could you be doing that in public?
It's California tantra.
So that's
neo-tantra. There's definitely this whole movement, and it's, you know, yeah, these are intimacy practices, and, you know, you think of our which is necessary, because we've been so broken in that respect, and also, you know,
oops,
about relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm sorry, I think I am getting another call, so the line is breaking up.
Yeah, I just heard a beep. Okay.
I'm so sorry about that.
That's
one
okay.
Second. But, you know, but really, again, this tantra is beyond just these sexual practices. So much in this culture is really based on these first and second, you know, the first and second chakras, and this, like, instant gratification and how to prolong your orgasm and have the most ecstatic experience. But there's so much more to it, mm-hmm, than that. That goes beyond what is offered in a lot of these neo-tantric teachings.
Well, I definitely need to know more about that, too. Let's see. Felicia, do you have anything for Laura?
I have a question. Can you hear me, Laura?
You're very faint.
I'll repeat the question once Felicia asks it.
I found it very interesting that there were, you know, 62 schools of Tantra, and there are many, many things. You know, I've heard that the teachings on the chakras come from the Tantric tradition, and I was wondering if that was the case. And I also thought it was interesting that there were so many schools of Tantra.
Okay, did you hear any of that?
I didn't.
Okay, hold on a second. You know what? I'm going to hand the phone to her. It's easier that way.
So I thought it was really fascinating to hear you say that there were so many different schools or lineages or traditions within Tantra, because sometimes I think people tend to group it all together as one thing. So I just wanted to comment on that. I thought that was fascinating. And the second thing, which is a question, is I have heard that some of the teachings on chakras and the subtle body and so on comes from some of these Tantric traditions, and I was wondering if you could speak to that or answer that, or if that falls under what you do in terms of your study.
Oh, yes, absolutely, because it is understanding, like you were talking about the koshas before, these five different layers within the aura, and then looking at the chakras, these different wheels, and depending on which system, there's seven or eight in the body, and they relate to different realms of our experience. For example, the first chakra relates to our physical reality, survival, security, our foundation. The second chakra has to do with relationships, creativity, sexuality. And so there are different practices specifically geared to looking, you know, to balance the chakras and see if, you know, we're more connected to one over another, or there's an area that's blocked, or, and we can see that too through by looking at different areas in life too, and the ways energies either are flowing or not. And the way that you can work with it is through mantra practice. Actually, in some of the teachings I do, I talk about the different yoginis and the chakras, that there's a different kind of female energy, and it's not necessarily only female in that gendered sense, but just this quality, this energy, this consciousness, that through reciting her mantras and looking at different aspects of her, looking at her iconography, for example, a lot of these fiercer goddesses, not only in the chakras, but in general that we see are holding, they have many arms, and they're holding different weapons and tools, and sometimes that can appear to be very frightening to those of us who aren't really familiar with what's going on, but they have this whole symbology that is very instructive, actually, in working within our own lives, and just even in this, you know, simplest level, the sword, a lot of them hold these swords, is really a symbol of discernment, and it's about spiritual discernment, or, you know, really coming back to the body, too, and listening to, checking in with your gut, you know, when you are in a conversation with someone and something doesn't feel right, you know, that's your third chakra saying to you, hey, something may not be in integrity here, and maybe it's time to, you know, call on that yogini or that part of yourself and wield that sword and really, you know, bring it down to just cut and have a more direct communication. So, yeah, again, just there's so many ways in, and it's fascinating, a huge, huge, huge subject area. So even to be speaking about doing an intro to Tantra at this festival is hardly going to do justice because of the various lineages and just opportunities that this tradition express, you know, invites us to explore. And everything on the show today has had Tantric elements in it, which is so fascinating. And you can see the similarities between Tantra and the Vedas and the different sects within the Hindu tradition. And so much already that we're doing, even in the yoga asana practice, would qualify as Tantric, and really the sense of finding the unity, you know, from the non-dual perspective. It's really about finding the unity behind life's differences, learning how to bridge these seemingly disparate parts, so, you know, that joy and sorrow, pain and bliss, darkness and light all are one, that all of this ultimately is consciousness. It's the divine. The Shaktas would call it goddess, that she is everything. You know, in the Kashmiri Shaivites, we call it Chittananda, you know, the bliss of consciousness. So it's really, this is a path of healing dichotomies, you know, between spirit and matter. And, you know, and by understanding that we're more than just our physical body, that we have these energetic bodies, too, that are providing us with information is definitely an important step.
Wow. And to think that I only gave us 15 minutes to talk about this. I mean, we could talk about this for hours and hours and hours and still not get our arms all around it.
Yeah, absolutely. We could talk about it for lifetimes.
Yeah, I guess so. But
there's so much information. And it's wonderful, but then also it's possible to simplify, too. And really, you know, there's infinite methods. And one, you know, is just for your meditation practice, even, you know, focusing on a form, maybe having, calling in a deity like Durga or Sarasvati, let's say, another goddess who's a goddess of creativity. She's a goddess of learning. She's a goddess of the arts and all its forms. And really, you know, having an image of her, a murti, and then getting her mantra or just reciting her seed mantra, which is I'm, over and over, and just experiencing that vibration in your body. And by having this practice, too, and the repetition of the practice, a ritual is an essential part of the tantric practice, and understanding our bodies, our physical bodies, as the altar, the puja altar, the ritual altar, and just, and, you know, using that in our exploration of what it means, of what this path means.
Wow. Okay. I will do that. How do you spell the seed mantra for Sarasvati?
It looks like AIM, but it's A-I-M, I'm.
I'm.
And just saying that over and over, japa, repetition, mm-hmm. because it entrains the brain. And there's so much, again, about how that kind of trickles down into the different layers of the subtle body, too, and generates this field. Tantra is about expanding our consciousness. And so working with these vibrations is a wonderful way of shifting our consciousness and coming back again to that place in the center, that place of composure. And then when difficult thoughts arise, or we feel blocked, maybe, you know, our creativity isn't flowing like, you know, we think it should. This is, again, everything in Tantra, if we can shift and see it as an opportunity and how we respond rather than reacting, is really the key.
Excuse me. Thank you. Well, sorry, but I have to cut you off because I'm looking at the time and we only have 5 minutes left in the show. My God.
Wow, what an exciting show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So
thank you, and I look forward to seeing you this weekend.
Yes, I will see you this weekend.
And we'll hear more about it. And do you have any book or anything like that?
Yes, my book, Goddess Durga and Sacred Female Power, is available on Amazon. And I talk in great depth about these different goddesses and so much of what I've shared today. And also I'll be teaching this fall a class coming up on August 31st called Tantra and the Fierce Goddess at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles. And then later in the fall, the 10 Tantric Wisdom Goddesses. And then I'll also be at Bhakti Fest and Exhale in October, teaching on the Yogini. So you could go to my website, too, which is lauraamazzoni.com. That's LauraAmazzoni. On the events page, there's a list of all the classes and workshops. I'm also going to be doing an event on Sarasvati and Lakshmi, these two goddesses of creativity and abundance, on August 28th at True Yoga.
Perfect.
So well, lots of different opportunities to go deeper.
Well, thanks a lot, Laura.
Great. Thank you so much, Joni. And thanks, Felicia.
And we look forward to seeing you soon.
Okay.
Jai
Ma.
Okay, Jai Ma. Bye.
Well, it sounds like we're about to wind down.
Wind down. So quickly before we end the show, it's the list of things going on in town this weekend. And so obviously Moksha Fest is the big thing. It's Saturday and Sunday. Starts Saturday at 9 o'clock in the morning with a big intro, puja, whatever it is, I think, at 9 o'clock in the morning. And it runs through 10 o'clock at night. The kirtan goes, I believe, from 6 o'clock till 10. And then on Sunday, it goes 10 to 10.
And don't forget the dance party on Saturday night at the Yoga Collective from 9 p.m. to midnight.
That's right. I saw that recently, and I'm thinking like, oh, but that starts at 9 o'clock, so everybody has to leave in the middle of Jai set. So no, you finish Jai first, then you head on over and dance at Yoga Collective with DJ Fabian Al-Sultani. So it's going to be real dance it up at Yoga Co. But okay, so Thursday, this Thursday, it's actually a pre-Bhakti Fest event with Allison Khan and Moose, or Masood Ali Khan, 7 p.m. at True Yoga in Santa Monica. There's going to be a class at 7:15 with Allison, and then some music with Moose at 8:45 p.m. Friday, oh, I have your note. There's a meteor shower on Friday. The Perseids, a meteor shower, apparently is happening Friday night. Although if it's cloudy with marine layer like it has been recently, we probably won't see anything. But, you know, if you're out in the middle of the desert, probably get some good viewing out there. 6 p.m. Friday, there's yoga and Steve Gold. Steve Gold is going to be playing live music at a class by Rosie Good at Yoga Bindu in San Pedro. Excuse me. 7:30 p.m., it's Om Shalom Shabbat yoga time with Zach Lodmer at the Yoga Collective. At least I hope it's that one. 8:30 p.m., Kirtan. Oh, Ashley Wynn and Lisa Florine at Bhakti Yoga Shala, 8:30 p.m. on Friday. And she's calling it a Mercury retrograde kirtan. I guess that's anti-Mercury retrograde. So maybe bring all your electronic devices and get the juju fixed so they don't go bad on you during Mercury's retrograde. Saturday, Moksha Festival. I have here noon at Fred Siegel. There's a Bollywood vinyasa flow class with Himalaya. It's 2 hours of Bollywood yoga flow. 3:30 p.m. Oh, this is free. No, not the Fred Siegel button, but this one in particular. This is a Shakti flow with Derbla Kelly and DJ Drez at In Yoga Center in Valley Village. 3:30 p.m. Like I say, it's free. 4 p.m. This is yoga and live music fundraiser for the Ama Yoga Foundation. It's provides yoga to those in homeless shelters. And this is in Malibu. It's 18820 Pacific Coast Highway. And Rudy, Metia, Govindas and Radha, Icona, it's yoga and music, all for a good cause at 4 p.m. Later on that evening, 9 p.m., this is the dance party that Felicia was referring to. It's the Moksha Dance Party at the Yoga Collective. Also, 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, Simrit Kaur, who also will be playing at Moksha on Sunday. Well, on Saturday, she's going to be at Golden Bridge in concert. So if you can't make Moksha, you can catch her at Golden Bridge. Finally, on Sunday, I have here, it says Shakti Dance at the Radha Govinda Temple at 7 p.m. That's in Venice at the corner of Rose and Hampton. It's about a block away from Exhale, if you know where Exhale is. And it's kirtan, dancing, art, and a vegan feast. Sorry. So all of that's going on Sunday. Do you have anything, Felicia, that you want to talk about?
I think you've covered all the weekend events. And I know I'll be at Moksha, so I'm hoping to see you there.
Yeah, definitely will be.
And Joni will be at Moksha, too.
I will be at Moksha, and I'll be actually working the LA Yoga booth. So if you've been curious to see what we both look like, you'll probably find us there if we're not busy roaming around. We haven't quite figured out how we're going to do that. And there are other people, too. The LA Yoga crew is a big crew. A lot of people who help put that magazine together. So let me see. Is there anything else we need to do before we end the show? Other than I'm going to close with something from Simrit Kaur. Like I said, she's going to be there Sunday, and she does have an album, and the name of the album is The Sweetest Nectar. And from that album, I'll be playing Wayanti, and it's a Kundalini chant. So I think with that going on, I think I can end the show. Say goodbye to all of you. Thank you, Felicia, for being here today. Thank you to Bill Levesey and to Laura Amazzoni for calling in and enlightening us with things that we may not have known much about. I'm speaking for myself, especially. So, and Felicia's trying to take a picture of me while I'm talking on the microphone. So until next week. This is Yoga Chat, and I'll talk to you next week.
Vahiyanti Kariyanti Jagidudu Pati Adhikitu Vaha Brahmadei Trisha Guru Itu Vahe Guru Vahiyanti Kariyanti Jagidudu Pati Adhikitu Vaha Brahma Dei Trisha Guru Itu Vahe Guru Vayanti Kariyanti Jagidut Pati Adhikitu Vaha Brahma Dei Trisha Guru Itu Vahe Guru
Brahmadei Trisha Guru Itu